Open Source is sponsored by listeners like you. Pitch in to keep the world's first podcast going strong. 15 years and counting. Find us at patreon.com/radioopensource. And thank you. I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source. The first publisher of Herman Melville's novel Moby Dick, or The Whale, wanted good readers to find inside the adventure story a pregnant allegory to illustrate nothing less than the mystery of human life. We take up the modern quest again this radio hour from several angles. Moby Dick as a textbook on tyranny, as eco-warning, as queer fiction, as a meditation on race, as American magic, and American tragedy. For a century now, Moby Dick has been read as something like American scripture, surely our greatest novel. It gets read as a complex mirror of the age before the Civil War, but also of a nation's fate for all time. We are testing the proposition this hour that Moby Dick speaks to the pandemic and politics of the strangest year any of us have known, 2020. Cornel West, Wynne Kelly, Alexander Chi, and Donald Pease will take their turns as key holders to Moby Dick. We'll begin with Jonathan Lethem in one contemporary novelist's tribute to the Melville model of experimental fiction. But first, Orson Welles intoning the opening lines of Moby Dick's narrator.
Call me Ishmael. Some years ago, never mind how long, I thought that I would sail about a little and see the watery part of the world.
He's a kind of everyman, and he's a kind of nobody, and he's a kind of a mask. You know, and one of the things you learn in reading Moby Dick over and over again is that the idea of masks, the faces we wear, the visage we present, it becomes very important. So even to himself, I think Ishmael is a kind of question mark, a walking question mark. And he remains a kind of a malleable and mysterious presence. He's very likable and very easy to be with initially, but the story doesn't stay completely inside his brain. You know, he becomes Melville. He becomes someone who can say and think and talk about anything. He transmigrates into the mind of other characters in the book, and he becomes this sort of superhuman narrator. And at the same time, he remains this likable, somewhat unformed, impressionable, searching young man.
He identifies himself early on as a devout spiritualist. He says, "Methinks my body is but the lees, the dregs of my better being." At the same time, he's an ordinary guy. He's us, every kid who was ever drawn to the sea, he speaks for.
Right. Well, that's one of the things that makes this book so resilient and so encompassing, or certainly engulfing, like a whale itself, to the mind of the reader, is that it functions so literally as an adventure story. Mm. There's always something at stake. There's always a physical reality, the terror of drowning, the feral power of the hunting for the whales, and the almost horror story. You know, it's like a body horror when they do capture the whales and they start stripping them apart and the deck becomes awash in blubber and blood. And you know, there's always a real physical adventure. They run into other ships. They're on all kinds of extra errands, along with chasing Moby Dick. Mm. By the time you've gotten to the end of this book, you'll have encountered all kinds of side adventures. And it's always also a kind of existential, philosophical journey. Everything is charged with religious or philosophical meaning and is much more than itself.
Jonathan, it's also, it seems to me, among other things, a sociology of work in the middle of the 19th century, men at work in all the precision of what they had to do. And whaling is a very particular calling. He says, I love this line, to the meanest mariners, renegades, and castaways, Ishmael ascribes the highest human qualities. The world of work is a democracy, but whalers are special. Harpooners are the most special, the most valuable. Queequeg is like none other. He's an athlete, he's a marksman, and he's the best man on that ship, Pequod. These are not sentimental jobs as Walt Whitman would describe them. They're very particular crafts, like Philip Roth's jeweler.
Well, absolutely. One of the things that is really enthralling in the book is the particularity of the roles and the way they are described as, you know, forming this kind of coherent crew, and everyone has their purpose and their place and their different capacities, and whatever their personalities, they're all serving this purpose. And then, of course, the horror of it is that the purpose is, you know, is being abused. They know what it is to be a whaler, and that Ahab has something else in mind, that it doesn't make sense to be putting their guild of expertise to this revenge story. And they all feel kind of misused by it.
Right, and Starbuck says it to Ahab's face. He said, I came here to hunt whales, not to follow any man's obsession. Speak of the officers on the Pequod, notably Starbuck, Mr. Coffey, the first mate, Nantucketer, from a family of whale men, then Stubb, Cape Cod man, which is different, and yeah. Flask from Tisbury on Martha's Vineyard. That's the whaling aristocracy. Right. Starbuck at the top for valor in whale battles. But he also says he will have no man in his boat who is not afraid of the whale.
You know, in a more ordinary kind of story, you'd look to Starbuck to be the pillar of sanity. You know, right. if you had a mad captain on a ship ordinarily, you'd say, well, you know, where's the second in command? And that would be Starbuck. He would be the guy who was strong enough and sane enough to confront the captain.
Doesn't get the job done. We have to.
No, he's out of his depth. You know, in a way, he's there to expose the limits of the rational man on this kind of voyage into the confrontation with the great unknown. You know, the realm of Ahab and Moby Dick and the realm of Queequeg and Ishmael is one that Starbuck is kind of an involuntary rider into. Mm. He really wants to be in a much simpler story. And that's when why he talks of fear. He wants to obey the sort of the natural laws and the natural limits. But the book is disobedient in precisely the way that exposes Starbuck's limitations.
And then the crew, 50 plus men, exacting skill in each one of them. They're from all over, the carpenter, the black cook Fleece, the blacksmith, more than 40 points of national origin, China, the Azores, Belfast, a lot of them island people from places like Malta, Tahiti, Sicily, and then little Pip, the black boy from Alabama. It's a nation of nations.
Well, I mean, they're very consciously idealized in their, what's called diversity these days, which is, it's kind of a pat term, but they're this sort of cornucopia of types and versions of the human, and they do amalgamate together into this brilliant whole, which is somehow a very evocative and very moving image that probably was a conscious symbol of possibility for Melville of the American experiment, the amalgamation of difference into equality and fraternity. Now, Melville,
right. dare I say, a labor union.
Sure. I mean, Melville doesn't get all the way there. There are all kinds of incompletenesses and stumbles, you know, and in many ways, the white characters are given a much greater delineation. It's almost as if he can idealize the multicultural, but he has trouble particularizing it, right? So it's sort of there, it's evoked, it's brought into view, and then he ends up talking about, you know, Stubb and Flask and and Starbuck a whole bunch. The dream is there, and I think the dream is kind of alive in the book, that this could be some sort of vision of a global multicultural apotheosis of human types into something very, you know, but this is why the book is so tantalizing, because it seems to be dreaming of things greater than its author can even know.
Jonathan, look ahead to Ahab. Who's your Ahab?
He's a great fictional character who everyone kind of recognizes, and it's as if he already existed and Melville just had to discover him or unearth him to make us recognize what an Ahab was. But, you know, where does this power come from? Well, one place it comes from is Shakespeare. Halfway through the book, I think Melville realized or became unembarrassed to accept that he was doing King Lear. This figure was a Shakespearean figure, and that he was partly cribbed from King Lear, which is why there's a whole chapter where Ahab shakes his fist at a lightning storm. He's consciously becoming King Lear.
What does the link with King Lear tell you about madness, the sources and origin of madness, the experience of madness? Or is he mad?
Right. Well, that's a good question. Is Ahab mad or is he just angry? It's a great revenge story, and it makes you feel the sadness of all revenge stories, is that they are stories of love and mutual destruction. The whale knows Ahab too well, and the whale has shown Ahab too much in himself. It's a great death pact. It's a great death cult that Ahab represents. And I mean, I guess that's a form of madness, but it's unfortunately a very historically powerful kind. The Ahabs of our history aren't madmen in being tended to in asylums. They're running the ship. That's the problem.
Jonathan Lethem, speak of the afterlife of this unprecedented novel, the afterlife of its storytelling, even among experimental novelists today, including yourself.
One of the great things about Moby Dick is the way it reverberates in culture. And, you know it before you know it.
Right.
Most people don't think necessarily that they even want to read Moby Dick, but they kind of learn about it anyway. You know, it's a classic comic. It's a Gregory Peck movie. It's the name of a Led Zeppelin song. It sort of crops up and you sort of find yourself absorbing little pieces of it. And it's there waiting for you, sort of stalking you as an image. But somehow there's a little drumbeat haunting you. This thing is cooler and crazier and more interesting than you can possibly know. And when you begin to see how many people have, in a way, taken Moby Dick like a drug and tripped out on it, and it's turned into an obsession. I mean, it makes sense that Elvis Presley, during his comeback special in 1968, lifts up his microphone stand and shouts Moby Dick. It makes sense that it's a joke in popular culture as well as a monument in literary history, because it's kind of everything.
Jonathan Lethem won a National Book Award 20 years ago for his novel Motherless Brooklyn. Ed Norton made a movie of it last year. Coming up, the ship's crew at the heart of this novel, Melville's mariners, renegades, and castaways. This is Open Source. Donald Pease at Dartmouth is eminent in the field of American studies. He's a literary and psychoanalyst of American culture, from Dr. Seuss to the great Melville, his ultimate authority on American dreams, the good and the horrific.
I do think that Melville wrote a book that was designed in its encyclopedic scope to constitute a kind of collective memory for America at that turning point in American history. He writes it in 1850. His father-in-law, Lemuel Shaw, who was opposed to slavery, was compelled, because of existing juridical constraints, to send slaves back to the South from his seat in Massachusetts. And he felt the deep paradox and profound contradictions that were circulating throughout American culture at the time. So he decides to construct a book that will hold America's deepest aspirations and its deepest nightmares in the same ship. It's a ship called the Pequot, because it's named after the most violent streak of the colonial settlers who came to the United States in order to get a new start in a new world, who understood it was an indistinction between the savage violence that they exercised against Native Americans and the clearing in the wilderness to enable a new vision for a new world to imagine. So Melville takes this churning psyche, and he brings together characters: Ahab, Starbuck, Ishmael, the crew,
Queequeg,
who will enable him to explore all of those contradictions, which are all the more visible today.
You say aspirations and nightmares. There's the whole story. in a certain way, and it keeps changing. But you're talking about the original America before nationhood, the nation before the Constitution, people free to find a new way, but traps keep coming up. The short history, please, of the disappointments, the new beginnings, the aspirations, and continually the nightmares.
Moby Dick, when it is published in 1851, is described by the vast majority of reviewers as the work of a lunatic whose imagination has been capsized by the vision that has overtaken him. That book, Moby Dick, remains, if you will, lost to the literary tradition until the aftermath of the First World War, when D.H. Lawrence's Classics in American Literature, written in England, which he envisions the United States as the inheritor of the responsibility previously imposed on Britain to become the leader of the free world. And at the same time, as he imagines the United States assuming that role, he sees Moby Dick as the narrative that has predicted not only the aspiration to achieve that role and the imperial drive of Ahab, but the consequences of the nightmare that can ensue. And he finds in Moby Dick a perfect summation of the contradictory relationship between the aspiration to produce a democracy in which equality and freedom are affirmed, and the underside of that, the need to turn those great principles and ideals into the basis for tyrannizing a planet, imperializing a world. He sees in Ahab a totalitarian drive, and he finds as the antithetical figure within Moby Dick, Ishmael.
Donald Peace, you're a special character in the history of reading Moby Dick because you revived a critic whose words had been lost, who gave us the modern reading. C.L.R. James wrote his book on Melville at Ellis Island, not as an immigrant, as a guy who was about to be evicted for his left-wing free thinking, but it's a reading that sticks. The idea post-Cold War that Moby Dick is a mirror of us. The people, the crew, are the hero. Ahab, of course, is the villain. Ishmael is sort of compromised. The crew is compromised. But it's a war between the aspirations of working people and the madness of an industrial system that alienates everybody. Bring it to the moment. I remember you and I talked about Moby Dick in Obama time. Obama, Kansas, and Kenya represented that global mind, global leadership. Trump now completely the opposite. Make America great again. Nations, interests, and we're number one. Walk us through these meanings.
C.L.R. James is a figure who, while on Ellis Island, still holds the position of a potential immigrant. He thereby represents everything and everybody Trump wants to depose, wants to deport. It was Trump's ambition to persuade, let's call it that, his base in both senses of the word, that the immigrant was the figure who was primarily responsible for depleting the United States of its vital resources and simultaneously making real Americans feel as if they had been left behind by a country that was under threat, because this is the deepest image of his fantasy, of becoming a third world country under the rule of figures like Barack Obama.
And in what degree is Ahab our warning?
Ahab had the capacity to turn the crew into the equivalent of a Trump base.
He won them over somehow.
By constructing a rally on the ship that did to the crew what Trump does with his rally base. Before Ahab appears in an official relation to the crew, the crew pass on stories about Ahab that they relate to their own sense, their own prior sense of lostness. When
the isolation,
isolation,
known as isolatos.
They're isolatos. And when Ishmael explains why he wanted to go onto the ship, the deep melancholy in his soul, the feeling that he didn't belong, the feeling that he was a radically uprooted, stateless man, whose melancholy could only be discharged, as he tells us, when he takes the oath with Ahab and feels this dread in his soul, what's driving him to identify with Ahab's monomaniacal quest. That's what Ahab is also doing with every one of the crew members in the quarterdeck scene. The quarterdeck scene could be understood to be comparable to a space on the Pequod. It's like a rally space for Trump. Technically, it's called a heterotopia. That it's a space that can't be sorted with other spaces because it's completely anomalous to other spaces. What Ahab does on the quarterdeck from the opening moment is he declares a state of emergency. They think it's because there's a hurricane coming. There is. But the hurricane is in Ahab more than the impending storm that's external to Ahab. And he's speaking to the crew from a sense that something that he once had has been completely dissevered from him. Think of all the all of the members of the Pequot who in 1848 had fled post-revolutionary Europe because their prior ways of life, they felt, had become completely unsettled. The crew come from islands and from continental nations all over the planet. And Ahab sees that what all of them share is Ishmael's deep sense of feeling utterly rootless on land and in need of something that will make them feel as if they belong. All of those that who are isolados, who have no sense of what it is they share, are when Ahab declares a state of emergency and then says, I'm going to release you from your ties to the Nantucket whale market and let you get in touch with that dimension of your soul that you feel is brought into play. Everything you confront, the possible loss of your life, a dead whale or a stove boat is what the crew scream out in response to Ahab's initial question on the quarterdeck. What do you do when you sight a whale, man? And when they get in touch with that glorious destructive drive, it's glorious because it's in them more than themselves. It's what makes them feel as if every time they confront a whale and survive, they've acted upon valor. They've acted upon the dimension of themselves that is the most base of drives, the other destruction. And they've converted it, they've sublimated into the noblest, the most glorious of drives, that which gives expression to valor, bravery. When Ahab picks up that gold coin and says, I'm going to give this to the first of you who raises the white whale, he's drawing out of the men the sense that there's something glorious we can live for and die for.
Donald Pease, the scene you describe on the deck of the Pequod, the political, imaginative, psychological power of Ahab over the crew, was all imagined 1850 by a 30-year-old guy who had been to sea, but he seems to see it all.
When Melville decides he needs to write Moby Dick, he's lived through the presidency of Andrew Jackson. And he's seen how that presidency appealed to, in the name of democracy,
Right.
Simultaneously, the deepest aspirations and the basest drives.
The man on horseback, the general.
The man on horseback and the common people. In fact, the reason Donald Trump invokes Jackson as his precursor, because he sees that it was Jackson who appointed Roger Taney, who gave us the fugitive slave law, as his Supreme Court justice. He sees that all of his appointments to the court were political, as are Trump, since there's no, he does not believe in the independence of the judiciary. He also had nothing but disdain for Native Americans, African Americans, and immigrants alike. So Melville sees in Jackson a prototype, King Andrew Jackson, a prototype for, let's call it, the totalitarian temptation of a democracy.
Go back to the characters in the book, starting with Ishmael, Call Me Ishmael, meets Queequeg, the ultimate exotic American, the officer crew, Starbuck and company, the crew itself, multinational, incredibly capable, and then the figure of Ahab, that C.L.R. James called the most dangerous and destructive type that has ever appeared in Western civilization. Use them in a modern sense, in our modern understanding, to explain why Starbuck and company did not prevail against Ahab, and why we still don't know what to do with Donald Trump.
Ishmael, on board the Pequot, sees that the ship is organized in a way that has given Ahab the complete power to turn this ship into an instrument, not of the purpose for which the industrial economy had designated for it. Whaling was one of the greatest industries of the 19th century.
Right.
He says that the industrial economy has become, if you will, the pretext for the exercise of a grandiose will to power that is the underside of the American desire to redeem the entire world by elevating the entire world to the desire to become a liberated democracy. Ishmael remains, as had all the other crew members, under the spell of Ahab until the moment he's asked to steer the ship. And as he's steering the ship, he realizes that he's fallen asleep and he's endangered the ship because everything's turned around. And as he realized that he has endangered the ship because everything's turned around, he turns around and sees this infernal spectacle taking place behind him, because the tri-works, the apparatus that converts whale blubber into oil, right, and it is filled with flames and screaming, as he puts it, demons. And he turns around and sees that what he believed would be a cure for his melancholy has taken him into the deepest pit of hell. It's at that point that he renounces his oath to Ahab and decides that if he survives, he will write a narrative. He will tell the story as the survivor, like the survivors of, say, Auschwitz, who bear witness to the horror that it is possible to imagine, even for America. And because Ishmael has decided to convert as witness and in narrative form as testimony to what he has borne witness to, it's his aspiration to enable those who read Moby Dick to recognize one of the possible fates for the American people. So that by way of that recognition, we can, like Ishmael, change our course. Ishmael did something in the narrative that it took COVID to do for most Americans. He separated himself. He, from everything that made what was happening on board the Pequot feel naturalized, feel normal. And when he did that, he was put into a position in which he could recognize what most human beings never have the opportunity to recognize, that it's possible to change your fate. COVID is a taste of a world in which humankind can become extinct. And the deepest significance of Moby Dick is that it imagines the extinction of all of mankind. Only the world before Noah's flood, populated by whales and other marine creatures, and life without human, has become the way of life for the planet. I think in this moment, when readers can begin to understand the deepest consequences of a course of action for the ship of state that will result in the devastation of the planet, also realize that we can get off that ship, change the course, and bear witness to the catastrophe that almost arrived.
Donald Pease, I understand everything a little better when I listen to you. I can't thank you enough.
I really enjoyed talking with you, Chris. Take care.
Donald Pease teaches remotely these days at Dartmouth College. Coming up, Melville Without End, on the cruel sea, on race, sex, and the blues. This is Open Source. I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source. Herman Melville said on publication of Moby Dick in 1851, "I have written a blasphemous book, and I feel as spotless as the lamb," meaning nothing was sacred in his imaginative life, not even the oceans. Benedict Cumberbatch reads here from Ishmael's reflection in chapter 58 on the full awfulness and cruelty of the sea, not just the violence to man and whale and ships, but the malicious effect on every one of the living species the sea itself created and sustains.
But not only is the sea such a foe to man who is an alien to it, but it is also a fiend to its own offspring. Worse than the Persian host who murdered his own guests, sparing not the creatures which itself hath spawned. Like a savage tigress that tossing in the jungle overlays her own cubs, so the sea dashes even the mightiest whales against the rocks.
Wynne Kelly, humanist and resident Melvillian at MIT, makes that cruelty of Ishmael's sea a point of entry into Moby Dick's resonances in 2020.
It seems to me the overwhelming thing about Moby Dick is the way the characters live within eternal and ever-present danger. The whale is a terrifying presence, and the characters are constantly being called out of their sleep and out of their meals and wherever they are to go, you know, race after this creature who could smash them to smithereens. The sense of personal danger and vulnerability is central to the book's effect. And reading it now, I'm just as taken with the heroism of the characters, the way that Ishmael finds humor and solace and human companionship in the midst of things that we can't even begin to understand, or that we can better now, living as we are, so that if you go out of your house and encounter another human being, you might be exposed to a fatal disease. It's not a whale. It's not going to smash you with his mighty tail, but it's about as shocking and stressful a situation as you can imagine. And that's what these men were living with day after day for 4 years at a time. And sometimes returning from this voyage alive, but permanently damaged by it. So to produce a book like Moby Dick out of an experience like that is to me a gift to where we are right now.
The thread in our conversations, Wynne, has been just this notion of a mirror that keeps revealing something new. The reality changes, but the mirror keeps changing, and what we see in it keeps changing.
Mm-hmm.
What do you see of the American story today in Moby Dick, the temptations, the traps, and the aspirations of American life, now more than ever, in a way?
it's really hard to escape the problem of racial justice and the way it's expressed in Moby Dick. And you have both the aspiration for a world where the sailors can live together and as a sort of a global gathering. And at the same time, you have the racial fight at the end of Midnight Fo'c'sle when the Spanish sailor and the African sailor Dagu get into a very violent confrontation. And it ripples out in so many ways. You know, in our current discussion of whiteness and white supremacy is really hard to miss. I think of Toni Morrison, whose essay in the 1980s about whiteness in Moby Dick really focused on the whale as representing racial whiteness and Ahab in pursuit of it in some way. And I think we see that pretty differently now. The whiteness of the whale is very different from the whiteness of Ahab, but it's still it's a very troubling picture of whiteness. And one that I think is really useful for our moment, Ishmael negotiating those different kinds of whiteness. And then Ahab's pursuit of the whale and the extraction of oil from this natural resource line up pretty well with our climate issues right now, with the sense that whiteness has been destructive to the earth as a historical phenomenon.
Wynne Kelly, keep reading, keep teaching.
Oh, thank you. It's such a pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Alexander Chi teaches creative writing at Dartmouth. He's written novels like Queen of the Night and essays that won the Randy Schultz Prize in Gay Nonfiction. He was thrilled on first reading to find what he least expected in Moby Dick, a love story. Alexander Chi, you describe yourself as obsessed with Queequeg in Moby Dick, and I want you to help us get to know him. The reader knows that he's Ishmael's first friend in the book. They have to share a bed in an overbooked inn in New Bedford. Ishmael writes, he seemed to take to me quite as naturally and unbiddenly as I to him. And when our smoke was over, he pressed his forehead against mine, clasped me round the waist, and said that henceforth we were married, meaning, in his country's phrase, that we were bosom friends. He would gladly die for me if need should be. Thus then, in our heart's honeymoon, lay I and Queequeg, a cozy, loving pair. What's going on?
Indeed, what is going on? The first time I read this, I was, let's see, it was 1999, and I had put off reading the book for a very long time. Just sort of afraid in a certain way of encountering, well, the sorts of Orientalist racism that one can find in this kind of material. And when I finally did read it, I remember thinking, why didn't anyone tell me that this novel was like this? By which I mean, why didn't anyone tell me that it was such a love story between these men? The emotional bond is the core of the novel to me. We become interested in how is this narrator making sense of these people he has fallen in with. And in particular, Queequeg is one of those people.
Let me just say, he is the exotic, tattooed, pagan cannibal on the trip. But even before it starts, he is way out of the cliché noble savage. He's an incredible athlete and performer. He's a wit. He is sort of dissed by a guy on a boat getting to Nantucket, and he tosses him in the air, lets him land on his feet, and then when he gets knocked overboard, he dashes after him and rescues him. Funny thing is, he's Ishmael's model of manhood in so many ways through the book. He can do anything.
Yes, and unfortunately, in order to survive, he has to. For anyone who has any experience remotely like his, you know that the way that he has gotten by in this world until now isn't just because he's okay at harpooning, but because he is incredible at it. That's how the people on the boat end up making room for him.
He's also a man of courage and soul.
I'm haunted by the moments where he's glimpsed by himself and seems to be lost in contemplation. You know, he has these moments where he's stunningly alive in the way that he talks and the way that he is moving around inside of the novel, but also those moments when he is still are quite beautiful and, you know, not as accessible to us from the narrator's point of view.
What more should we be listening for in his silences at that incredible moment late in the book where he builds his own coffin and then almost lives in it?
It's so heavy-handed that it's almost a camp note in the novel. It starts to feel like a boat within a boat. Mm. It's as if he's preparing for the voyage after this, and I think no one is prepared for it except him.
Finally, and always worth waiting for, Cornel West, the lay preacher and public intellectual, bearer of prophetic fire in the African-American tradition. He spoke to us about Moby Dick and Melville the Blues Man.
Melville himself, it's a profound sense of the tragic. Mm. Looking at America from the underside. You remember at the very beginning of the novel, Ishmael goes to the black side of town. He goes to the trap.
Right.
It's a black church. Talking about Tophet, talking about hell. The preacher's preaching on the blackness of darkness. So he wants to tell the truth, and the truth oftentimes is in the grave. It needs to be excavated and resurrected, brought to bear into the light. And that truth has to do with not just the darkness on the soul of each and every one of us, but the darkness shot through the underside of the American project, which is indigenous peoples and genocide, which is black peoples and slavery, which is women in patriarchal households, with gay brothers, lesbian sisters, and bisexuals, and trans, precious trans folk being trashed and dishonored. Melville is the greatest American novelist, and America finally is beginning to catch up with him. The chickens are coming home to roost. We're reaping what we sow. He said, look, well, you think you can evade the truth. You think you can repress the truth. This is the repressed coming back. And Donald Trump is American as cherry pie, but he represents the worst that Melville was talking about. Now, for me, probably the most fascinating character in some ways, there's so many fascinating characters, but we often overlook.
We know them all, too, in real life, really.
Oh, absolutely. Starbucks, we can go across the board.
Manly men, failed men, messed up men, working men.
That's true. All colors. It's a working class. L.R. James talks about this in his great book that he wrote there in Ellis Island. It's a working class project, but very, very male, of course. The patriarchy is still there.
But the only heroes, James said, the hero of the book is the crew.
Very important, because Pip teases out the tender moment in Ahab. Ahab oftentimes is stereotyped as if he's just an egomaniac. He's just a narcissist. He's just a cold and cruel person who's wounded and trying to express his revenge.
Mm.
But Pip is a little black boy.
Yes.
Who teases out of Ahab this unbelievable tenderness and sweetness. And we don't associate Ahab with sweetness or tenderness, but it's there in the text. What is the relation between this gangster-like figure obsessed with this whale and the whiteness of that whale tied to white supremacy in America then and now? And Pip, who's not so much just simply naive and innocent, but he's also a very soulful person. He's out of step. He represents dissonance. We don't know whether he's disabled, physically challenged, but from the disablement, from the sense of being physically challenged, he's able to provide by example a depth of humanity that can actually touch the humanity of a gangster like Ahab.
He leaps out or gets shot out of a whale boat and is never the same.
We don't know whether it's his head, concussion, it's hard to say. It's clear he doesn't have both paddles in the water. But so what? He's still a human being. Still made in the image of God. He still has a capacity to solicit unbelievable gentleness out of a gangster like Ahab, you see. No, Melville, there's nobody like him. I go to his grave every year. He's in Woodlawn, right in the Bronx. It's right around the corner from the Jazz Corner with Duke Ellington and Lionel Hampton and Max Roach and Illinois Jacquet and Jackie McLean. They all are buried, and right around the corner is Melville's grave with his son who committed suicide. But we've yet to catch up with Melville. He's too frightening. He's too truth-telling. He's too unsettling. Mm. But the American empire today is having a profoundly Melvillian moment. It's having to confront in the most raw, coarse, ugly, but undeniable way the worst that we have done in the past and how that continues to haunt us. Mm. Our deep white supremacy, the unbelievable grotesque wealth inequality, the patriarchy running amok, the greed, the envy, the resentment, the hatred. It's not just the neo-Nazi brothers and sisters. They just the peak of an iceberg. And they are as American as apple pie, as John Coltrane, or Martin Luther King Jr., Mary Lou Williams, as American as apple pie. We got the worst and the best struggling. And right now, the best is in no way triumphing. At the very end of Moby Dick, what do we have? A coffin serving as a raft.
Bobbing up.
Ishmael holding on for dear life. It's that unhopeful, nearly hopeless hope. It doesn't get more threadbare than that. It doesn't get more tightrope-like than that in terms of its hope. That's not American optimism at all. It's over against the optimal mode that we see often in Ralph Waldo Emerson, a figure, of course, Melville criticizes in The Confidence Man.
Oh, yeah.
But no, Moby Dick, I think, bears not just our rereading, but our wrestling with that text. There's nothing like it in the world. Toni Morrison's read of Moby Dick and her playing in the dark is one of a wonderful moments in the history of literary criticism, because who comes out of Melville? Henry Adams. Who comes out of Melville? Faulkner. Who comes out of Melville? Toni Morrison. Who comes out of Melville? Thomas Pynchon. All of the great truth tellers at the level of high level of literary creation in this nation. But there's nobody like Melville. None of them are as deep as Melville.
I love the jazz connection. Melville was the guy almost too deep for the Concord Circle.
Oh.
Nobody knows whether Emerson read the book. Ben Webster was the deep Kansas City voice who left the Ellington Band, too.
Yeah,
there's a correspondence there somewhere.
No, it's true. No, I think Melville was just much too frightening for Ralph Waldo Emerson. I mean, I think the dialectic between Emerson and Melville is a crucial one. I mean, I've argued in Democracy Matters, as you know, the Emersonian tradition and the Melvillian tradition. Mm. And the blues is much more Melvillian.
Yes.
There's no doubt about it. You know, Sterling Stuckey has argued that Melville grew up among a lot of black folk when he moved to Albany. It was deeply immersed in black culture, was obsessed with black music.
Mm.
It's a powerful book.
Didn't know.
Oh, yeah, Sterling Stuckey, a professor at University of California, Riverside. And we know that Melville was very much obsessed, if not fixated, on black cultural forms from speech, like Twain, like Mark Twain, but also music especially. So that we've got some fascinating connections.
This would have been
connections.
Slave music, Christian music.
Oh, slave music
people's
to the
music.
Core. But, I mean, these are free Negroes up in Albany, but it's tied to slave music, to black music's tied to slave conditions. But these would have been free blacks.
You've done it. I want to let you go. You've.
Is it 10 minutes already?
I don't know. Wait. And if you got more to add, do it. But the pip.
Oh yeah, that's true. No, I think we hit it. But Lord, that was nice of you to hit it.
Thank you, Cornell West. Thanks also to Alexander Chi, Wynne Kelly, Donald Pease, and Jonathan Lethem. Please consider supporting Open Source by becoming a monthly subscriber on Patreon. You'll get extras like Adam Coleman's ongoing series about reading in a time of social distance. This week, he talks about disaster literature with Eliza Gabbert, whose new book is The Unreality of Memory. Find that conversation and more at patreon.com/radioopensource. The reading by Benedict Cumberbatch was from the Moby Dick Big Read, curated by the author Philip Hoare, commissioned by the Arts Institute at the University of Plymouth in England. You can hear their entire reading at MobyDickBigRead.com. Our show this week was produced by a crew of skilled shipmates, Connor Gillies, Adam Coleman, and Michael Garth. Mary McGrath sits in our crow's nest. I'm Christopher Lydon. Join us next time for Open Source.